It really was another day, another chance to quit. We were not joking.
Honestly. But that's also what we could have said before we started Never Have I Ever. Well, you were planning on quitting, actually.
I was fully planning on never starting, actually. Do not don't misrepresent me. I was fully planning on just never watching it so I could stay in my blissful little bubble. Don't poke the South Asian bubble. Hey, guys. It's me, Trisha.
Hi, it's Ambar. Today we talk about Mindy Kaling's Never Have I Ever, faux cultural capital and diversity in media, as well as Mindy Kaling being a sellout.
Basically, the takeaway from today's podcast is do not claim to know someone's brownness more than their own.
Enjoy!
So, Never Have I Ever. by Mindy Kaling.
It was a quarantine watch. It came out in April on Netflix. 10 episodes, super easy to get through. Each one's like 20, 30 minutes. Right. So the basic plot is that Devi Vishwakumar is 15. She's from Sherman Oaks, California. And after a traumatic freshman year in which she goes to a recital, and during her recital, her father suffers from a heart attack and dies. And then for the remainder of the year, she is paralyzed, just like inhabiting that trauma. And upon seeing a gorgeous high schooler who is actually 28 in real life, and it's really
29, it's 29. Horrible.
Oof. Yeah. Paxton Hall Yoshida, she suddenly regains the ability to stand and walk. And so the rest of the school year follows her trying to lose her virginity, going through therapy, fighting with her mother and her beautiful cousin Kamala, and like struggling with her Indian identity.
Yeah, that was a good plot summary. Okay, so now that you've said that, the podcast is over. This was just a plug. We're just plugging the show. Thanks, Mindy Kaling, for the sponsor. Just kidding. She doesn't sponsor her own community. Anyways.
So the first couple of episodes, now I'm Latina. I have no connection or background with Southeast Asian identity. So what I picked up on was very limited compared to what Trisha was able to pick up on. I remember the first couple episodes, they were really slow. But I feel like after Ganesh Puja, they just kind of pick up, at least in terms of storytelling. I thought it was a good chance for representation, but there were a couple of moments even I noticed where I was like, oh, I don't think this is representative at all.
Yeah, no, totally agree. I mean, there were things I really, really liked about it. And obviously the show came out on the auspices of being representation for a certain community that has often been underrepresented to some regard. And so I think the first thing that I just truly like about it is at least it represents something. It's not perfect. In no way is it even close to being perfect.
Yeah.
But it is nice to see people who look like you, who have a culture similar to your culture, or even have a culture at all, really, and express that in a way that's like normalized.
You really called out white people.
No, I did. I said, you don't have a culture. But yeah, that was what was so great about it. Like seeing that stuff being normalized was great. So it kind of made the show relatable, especially from like an American teenage aspect, because obviously even American teenagers, I think, who don't have a double consciousness can still relate to like family drama. They can still relate to sexuality issues and things like, you know, there was just so much packed in that show, at least to speak to representation, that it wasn't just a linear kind of look at like South Asian communities. It was a look at, you know, the South Asian community, the gender fluidity of teenagers, the, you know, single parent households, because, you know, that's what Eleanor has. Also, backtrack, if you've never seen the show, this is not going to be a great podcast for you.
No. And it also, if perhaps you liked it and you didn't think anything was wrong with it, that's completely up to you. Again, these are just opinions. But also, I think we present some really valid facts as to why it really failed. Yeah. In a lot of ways. Definitely. But I guess to start up, continue off on that positive note, what are some things as an Indian American woman that you felt were not good or at least accurate?
Okay, I take a long silent pause right there because here's a nuance that I think a lot of people don't understand. And I'm sure this happens to a lot of people of color in their communities, is this like weird generalization of your community. Like if you're Indian, you're just Indian, period. There's no like nuance in that. but there is. I hate to break it to you, but India is broken up into quite a lot of regions and states and areas that are vastly, vastly different. And so I just happen to be from an area that is unlike quite a lot of India. So for me, not a lot of the show is accurate at all. In fact, it completely misses the mark of accuracy, but it's funny and it's likable. However, speaking from just like general South Asian perspective, I think some things are certainly accurate, I'm sure. Like, you know, the scene where Devi goes to Ganesh Puja, I think that was such a great moment. And I definitely have experienced that in my lifetime, and I'm sure you have too. When Devi goes to Ganesh Puja, I think Mindy Kaling did a really great job of assessing the issue of double consciousness in that moment, where Devi finds an old friend of hers who's already gone to college, and she's like, why are you here? Like, why do you still come to these things? You know, and he's like, why would I want to be the guy who's like an Indian who hates being Indian? Like, that's not cool. And there's a weird moment of when you're young, you have this realization of like, you hate everything about yourself, especially like the culture in which you come from, because it's like differentiates you.
Yeah.
And I think that was like such a well done, accurate moment in which she's super self-effacing and self-hating. And she thinks that's the cool way to be. And she's like, ew, this is so gross, right? It's so Indian. And everyone's like, yeah. It is like, it's a beautiful thing. You get to go to another country and still celebrate the same culture that you have. But that realization takes time, you know? I think that was like a super accurate scene. You know, there were like a couple other ones. I don't know. There were like a lot of inaccuracies again, like in terms of, I can't even speak to the experience of South Indians, right? Because I'm not one. So I'm not entirely sure what they would have found accurate in a sense. Like, I'm not really sure what how religious they are. Like, I thought that was accurate, but maybe Mindy Kaling like overplayed that, right? Like in the beginning, she's praying and stuff like that. Although I do got to say the textbook thing was funny to me too, because Indians have a weird thing with books. It's like, you got to do little head chest touch every time you like touch a book, or like drop it on the floor, touch it with your foot.
Yeah.
God forbid you touch it with a foot. Your mom's going to kill you. Like, all my South Asians out there, you know what I'm talking about. But yeah, they're just like moments where those things are true. But I think also Mindy Kaling definitely relies on stereotypes. But before I get into that, I would like to hear from you what you felt was like very relatable, or anything that you just like felt, especially because you're not a South Asian, but you watch the whole thing anyways. There must have been something drawing you to it, or at least keeping you entertained.
So I don't know what it's like for Southeast Asian families and therapy, but I do know that in the Latin community, going to therapy is seen as shameful. This isn't something I've encountered from my immediate family per se, but definitely my overall family, where going to see a therapist is not only breaking like the family bonds of loyalty, where you have a problem in the family, you keep it in there. And so the idea of seeing Devi with a woman of color also as a therapist was really beautiful. And even when her mom goes to therapy later and like unpacks the shame of going, I don't know, that reminded me of things I've seen with my own. I guess, yeah, with Ganesh Puja, even though I have never experienced anything like it, I have hated coming home and my parents just having Dominican food on the table, or going to parties and feeling completely out of it because I can't dance and that's something there. Honestly, I related more to Fabiola than anything, but that's
right.
That's just, you know, my own Latin experience.
No, I absolutely get that.
I do feel for Devi. I think she is going through a lot, even if her story wasn't written as well. That's a lot to put on a kid.
Yeah. I mean, I think Mindy Kaling does a really good job, I agree with you, of addressing the whole therapy thing and addressing her sort of victimhood in a sense. She does a really good job of being like, Devi's not just like this weird singular character who like all she does is being South Asian. Well, okay, I take that back, actually. I recant. She doesn't do a really good job of it. She tries to. I think she attempts to make that clear. She tries to normalize Devi as like a multifactorial character, which is great. But I guess this is where I'll get into like where I felt she was stereotyping in a sense, is that she diminishes that effort, that attempt to normalize all these things by focusing very strictly on how Indian she is. And you can obviously disagree with this, but what I felt when I was watching it especially was clearly Mindy Kaling was trying to normalize like human complexity. You know, she was clearly with Fabiola, with Eleanor, with Devi, she was trying to sort of make these things seem like normal, everyday things that happen to teens everywhere. But then she sort of backtracks on that point during every single episode by specifically focusing on how Indian Divi is in whatever regard. And I'm like, I'm not really sure if she's trying to emphasize it or not. I was like, I thought the purpose was to not and just let people, you know, like ride with it. But then if that's the purpose, she fails. But then if the purpose is to emphasize it, then I'm not really sure why she chooses certain moments to just not ever mention it, and then certain moments to fully immerse the story in that one facet of her life.
So what were some moments in the show that was incredibly apparent to you?
Oh my God. Okay, so I mentioned Ganesh Puja. Like, that was definitely one of them. That was a really good episode, but the whole episode was heavily reliant on her being Indian and their forward. I also mentioned that textbook thing. Like, the show opens with her praying in front of this little mantle that, like, all South Asians have. We all know. I know you. I see you. But, like, it's very reliant on that weird trope of, like, I don't know. It just seems like it generalizes as well, which I'm weirded out by, because I'm like, as a South Asian, I would never think to generalize that moment. I'm trying to figure out how to articulate this in the best way that I can. I think the show came out as a... it got marketed basically as the representation for South Asians, okay? Which is fine with me. And I'm like, that's cool. But the problem with that is it plays right into what the majority already feels about us. That is my issue with the show. And again, I stated those two instances. All the fake accents, oh my God, just hire people who have accents. Or get rid of the accent. They don't need them. They don't have... your parents don't have to be first generation then.
Are you referring to Kamala's lovely voice? Yeah,
Kamala, the dad, Mohan.
Like, Daddy Mohan.
You don't have that accent. Like, just all the random people with these, like, horrible, just, like, sort of brown-facey accents. I'm like, what? Why? Why that choice to, like, impress upon the people this sort of, like, Apu, like, I don't know. Why do that? Why would you make that choice? The whole arranged marriage thing, that was really stretched out and weird to me.
Yeah, can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah, that played heavily into tropes.
That's a lot to unpack, but I feel like what I keep coming back to the most is the moment where Kamala speaks to the woman, I forget her name, who was ousted from the community because she had married a Muslim man. And so, yeah, the conclusion at the end of that is not do what you want. It's stick to homogeneity, however you say it. Yes. And also don't marry a Muslim. And then no one talks about that moment again. No one subverts that claim.
No, absolutely. There's totally a sense of anti-Muslim rhetoric kind of underlying that whole situation. And I think Mindy Kaling had a really good chance there to address South Asian Islamophobia, because it's there and it's rampant. Like, that is not a completely made up situation. That would happen. Honestly, if I'm being honest, that would totally happen in the South Asian community. If a girl ran off with a Muslim man, that it would be the end of her life, period. Honestly, she wouldn't even have to run off. If she even brought the guy home, it would probably be the end of her life. I'm sure there are South Asians out there that are definitely more accepting or just, like, literally don't care. But there are a lot more South Asians out there that do. And that has to do a lot with, like, Indian history and, you know, Indian politics and just the way that rhetoric is everywhere in India. But Mindy Kaling had a really, really good chance there to subvert that claim. Like you said, it's like the ending was just kind of like, no, listen to your parents and I regret even, you know, marrying a Muslim. Like, now I'm whatever. And she had a really good chance there to combat that. She could have easily had this woman actually come to terms being like, yeah, I regret marrying a man who wasn't right for me, but it had nothing to do with the fact that, you know,
yes,
he's Muslim. She could have done a plethora of things with that, honestly, and she really left it very flat, which I feel like, again, she does with a lot of things in that show that I'm not necessarily happy with, where she just kind of allows it to fall flat when she really could have done something with it.
So speaking on that level, I don't know how accurate this is because this is just the Wikipedia page, but it does say on the episodes who directed it and who wrote it. And quite a few of the names here appear to be from either white writers or people of color, sure, but not Southeast Asian people.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to diversify your writer's room, and it's certainly another thing to actually have people who are writing the stories that they've lived, you know?
No, absolutely. And earlier I said that I wasn't even going to watch the show. So for anyone listening, here's the explanation of why I've often accused Mindy Kaling of whitewashing. That is my biggest problem with her. She tries to make things very palatable for the audience, which you have to do in this consumer culture, especially in America. No one will watch your shit if it's not palatable for the white audience. And that's just fact right now for the industry. That's true. So I don't necessarily blame her, but I definitely wouldn't look to her as the best representation for a certain group of people, because I think she definitely would, she would allow this community to be misrepresented so long as it was comfortable for the white audience to watch. And she did that with the Mindy Project. And yet again, she's doing it with Never Have I Ever. And she did it in Parks, not Parks and Rec, The Office. You know, I only mentioned Parks and Rec, by the way, is because Aziz Ansari was on that and I accused him of the same behavior. But yeah, she did that in The Office too, where she just kind of sort of played this valley girl, but she was South Asian. And I was like, there's no way that you just subsume one culture and not the other. Like, yeah, I think she definitely, her writer room, like, again, the show was made on the auspices of being representation, but what it fails to do is accurately represent. So it puts the people of color in your face and it throws a little bit of the tropes out there to make you feel culturally woke or whatever. But it doesn't do enough to make those things valuable or meaningful in any way.
It just reminds me of Toni Morrison and the infamous interviews in which there's that one with the white woman where it's like, when will you write about white characters? And then from Charlie Rose, Toni Morrison said, I've had reviews in the past that have accused me of not writing about white people, as though our lives have no meaning and no depth without the white gaze. And that's, I feel, you can easily apply that to Davy, right? I'm wondering how the show would have been different if it was out of Mindy Kaling's hands and packaged and written by Southeast Asian people, you know?
Davey, you also have to consider how many little people, and I find that an unfortunate thing, which is why I don't completely blame Mindy Kaling necessarily. It's just, you would also have to consider viewership in that case, because if you don't make something palatable, it's an unfortunate consequence of our society in which no one will watch it. If something is not outwardly relatable from the 2-minute trailer, nobody is going to watch it. And I know a lot of people argue, well, that's just entertainment, get over it. But it's not. It doesn't have to be. Like, if I want to market my show for what it is, that doesn't mean you shouldn't watch it just because you didn't see anybody that looked like you in it. I've watched plenty of shows that were only white people, and they were good shows. It's a matter of being able to give something a chance based on what you think might come out of it, you know?
So in that case, why don't we talk about shows that do show these underrepresented groups but weren't made for the white gaze? Or they are, but at least it sticks true to its authenticity. Like, we can definitely see that with, like, Hentified. I haven't watched On the Block, but I remember you talked about it so
funny. Yes, On My Black People Come Out. That show is quite amazing because I don't know if this is true for you. I think a lot of entertainment that comes out is very focused on diversity in terms of race. Like, the industry especially is going in this weird direction where they're like, racial diversity representation is so important. I'm like, it is. Don't get me wrong. That shit is. But economic diversity is such a big thing. Like, you cannot just have a bunch of races out there making, you know, befriending each other. And this is, again, is something that I'll point out in Never Have I Ever, is that Davy also belongs to the upper class. Like, she is not a lower class citizen. No. All her friends are part of the same economic group, like all of her crushes, everything. Like, the high school seems to have a certain economic basis. It's just very, like, middle to upper class setting, which is fine because most people consider that the norm, which it's not. And I think that's a very interesting thing. That's what I love about certain entertainment, is when they can speak to economic disparity, especially in teenagers, because there are teenagers who really go through some level of intersectionality that I just think Never Have I Ever just does not even address. And it's so fascinating about On My Block is that they do that really well. They not only show kids who come from, like, an urban area or a low-income area, but they also show the contrast to that and the way they interact with other worlds outside of their own, the way the world views them. And it does not try, especially, I think that show does not try to cater to anybody's view. They just sort of represent sort of a kaleidoscope. They're like, I will just show you everything and it'll be messy. But if you try and focus, you'll see something really cool. And that's what I like about it, is it doesn't try and neatly package something that's not neat. It's just not neat. You know, people's economic experiences and racial experiences are just not neat, little, cute, funny packages. And we can't just pretend like they are and then feed it to them. I mean, we could, which is what we're doing.
I think you could also say, if we're talking about how On the Block does not cater to white people, we can't say that without talking about how Dear White People is for white people, but it's still authenticating, yes. That's the word, the experiences of the Black community.
No,
absolutely. I just finished the third season, so I'm like super invested in Chester and Lionel. Oh my God.
Yeah, no, we care about every character on that show. But also it's so great because that show, I just love that show. Everyone is just attractive and woke, and it's such a good show, especially about, again, it addresses, I like the way that it does the whole intersectionality thing without being all neat and cute about it. And I like that it especially addresses higher education. Again, I literally cannot tell people enough that it's not just about racial inequality. It's not just about economic inequality. There's also such educational gaps in our society. And there are just so many issues in our society, right? We have religious issues. We have racial issues. We have education issues. We have economic issues. The list goes on. Gender issues. You know, the list goes on and on and on and on. It could go on forever. But there are shows that give these things attention that are just not viewed because they're sort of marketed in a way that's not easy, I guess. It's not convenient. I recently had a conversation with my sister about this, actually, because I was talking about Insecure on HBO, which is Issa Rae's show. And I was saying that, you know, it's really sad because it's a very good show. It's such a good show. It's funny. It's relatable. It's political. It's all the above. Quite frankly, it's like one of my favorite shows at this point. But I was talking to her about how it's really sad, how it just didn't get the sort of notice it should have gotten. She's like, plenty of people watch it. And I said, yeah, plenty of Black people watch it. Sure.
Mm.
And she was like, no, other people watch it. And I was like, comparatively though, to other shows, Black people are pretty much your viewership for that show. And it's crazy to me that other people won't watch it because they think it's a quote unquote Black show. And I think that's what's happening to Dear White People. I think that's also what happened to On My Block. You know, I think a lot of people are like, this is a this person show. Like, I don't know if I'm going to get it. I don't know if it's for me to watch. And my sister even said, she was like, well, I think they should have just marketed it differently then. And I was like, why though? Why should they have to lie about whatever it is to get people to watch it? She just marketed it the way it is. It's about a Black girl in her community in LA trying to like live her life. If that immediately turns you off and you're like, oh, I can't watch that for whatever reason, then you need to consider what is in your head. Like, what is stopping you from watching a show about that? Even I'm not Black. I'm South Asian. I've watched the whole show and I did not feel any discomfort. I did not feel any sort of, it was relatable to the core as a woman. As I imagine, even if you were a dude, there's so many well-written male characters on that show too. It's like, where are you coming from that representation or unrelatability, perceived at least, stops you from consuming certain entertainment? I think that's an important question, you know?
Yeah. I guess in terms of the marketing, I'm reminded of, I know you don't watch Riverdale, but I do. But I noticed in the last couple of seasons, the one Black character they have that's a regular now, only exists to be a love interest. And the only other people of color characters there also serve the same purpose, unless you're Veronica, in which you're embodying the spicy Latina thing. But with the marketing in that show, I noticed characters who I barely see in the episodes are always on the billboards with these white characters. And so if that's the marketing that gets white people to watch these shows that incorporate diversity, I still don't want it.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the industry has really focused, like zeroed in on tokenism, which I hate, because they feel like one or two people of color is enough diversity to have a claim to diversity. And no one has asked for that. I think that's the sad thing, is that people of color have been woefully misrepresented in that industry as people who are asking for diversity and not actual representation, but we're asking for both. We're asking for like an accurate representation of diversity, not just one or two people who have no storyline, no plot, unless it's in relation to the main characters. Or even if they're the main character, they, like, fall flat. Mm. And it's what I'm accusing Never Have I Ever of, which is something I'll also accuse Crazy Rich Asians of. I know a lot of people like that movie, and I'm not, you know, shitting all over the film. It's, like, a good film as it is. I just think it also falls flat in certain ways. Again, it represents a sort of upper class, like, culture, which I know it's supposed to be, like, a fun rom-com-y film, but if you're gonna do, like, a whole representation thing, and that's, again, the thing you're building your platform on is representation. You're like, this is gonna be representation for these people, like, you know. And again, it feels good to see people who look like you on screen who have certain experiences that resemble yours. But for the first part of for the most part for that movie, it just kind of plays into the same rom-com-y tropes as, like, any other white film.
So I remember that some people have argued that perhaps that is the point, to show that people can experience these things and still not be white.
Yeah, and that's a great thing, right? But it's, again, it's that idea of, like, they're trying to normalize it, but then their entire platform is representation. So I'm not sure if you're pitching representation or if you're pitching normalcy. I just had this conversation again with my sister about Sex Education. If you've never seen that show, please, please, please go watch it. Great show. We were just talking about how Sex Education addresses things like homosexuality, you know, just like young people, sexual, whatever, mental health, low income stuff, like disability. That show just, like, goes through all of it. But the greatest thing about that show is not only does it address all these things, it never mentions that it addresses these things. Not once does the show even bother being like, this is a really obvious point we're trying to make, which is, again, it's a British television show, and I think that might be part of it. But I think America really needs to work on again, this weird performativity where they need to market these things as the thing, because then it takes away from the idea that we're all just normal. I think it even more adds to this weird segregated idea of, like, you're your own thing. You have your own movies. You have your own this. And I'm like, what if we had just released that film as is? And sure, critics would have been like, oh my God, representation is everywhere in this film. That's great. And that would have just been it. And it would have been, like, this beautiful moment in which everyone would have just been like, yes, oh my God. It just, like, was released and this film had so much representation, blah, 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 blah. But because I think even before it was released, there was just all this hoopla about, like, what we're going to talk about. And this is what the film actually addresses. And this is what it, and it's like, so you're telling people already before they go in that it's for them and that it's going to represent them and it's going to be about them, their experiences.
Imagine, because I know that I see the point and I do agree, but I'm also curious as to, maybe there is cause for bringing that out if that was the first thing of its kind since the Joy Luck Club. You know, maybe some of these things do deserve that celebration and that, like, this is what this is about if it's been so long.
I mean, I think they do, but then that kind of brings me back to my point is, like, if you do that, then I personally think you have a responsibility to do more with it then. Because if your whole platform is built on representing this whole public, but then it's just a film about people falling in love, that's fine then. But you have to decide which one it is, because I really don't think that you could accurately really have both. Because at some point, I think the film also just loses its representational value. You know what I mean? I think sometimes it's okay with sacrificing it for the plot. And I'm like, okay. But then stop trying to make it so obvious that these people are whatever. You know, I think if you have to specifically point out that somebody is Asian in the movie over and over and over and over again, you can't just pretend that's normal, because that doesn't happen in real life. So if you want to make the story real, then yeah, you can add those things that you want to make sure people understand that this person is a part of an entirely different culture. But pointing it out every 2 to 3 seconds doesn't happen in my life. And if it happens in yours, I'm really sorry. If you, like, go out and, like, every single second something Asian happens to you, that's crazy.
Something Asian happens to you.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, in that movie, it starts with, like, all these Asian girls, like, freaking out, and then they text people and it goes all the way to Thailand. And I get it. But then, you know, the movie moves on. She's talking about playing these Asian games, and then they're talking about going to Singapore, and her mom's talking about language, and they're talking about what dress she can wear to the house, and all this stuff is like every second of the film focuses so deeply on one aspect of her life, but then also tries to force normalcy. And then people are like, yeah, but wasn't it so normal? And I'm like, does that happen to you? Was that normal for you? Because I feel like this movie was a giant hoopla of representation and nothing else. I'm trying to think of a movie that does it really well.
You mean The Farewell?
Oh my God, yes.
Well, I guess I think of The Farewell, and it's a movie entirely in subtitles. I don't know if our listeners know what it is, but it's about a young Asian woman named Billy, whose grandmother is close to death, and her family decides to keep it a secret from the grandmother as part of like a cultural norm. But being Americanized, Billy is distraught, and so she's torn between these two identities and wanting to stay with her grandmother and also wanting to live just a life separate from structure, norm. I think towards the end of the movie, you realize that Billy wanted to stay in China because she and her family immigrated when they were very young, and so she was just alone most of her life. Really beautiful film.
It's such a good film. But see, that movie does it really well, right? It doesn't try and cater to anything. It doesn't even try and like falsely normalize something. It just acts as if this was someone's life, which I think personally forces you to normalize it. It's like if you're watching the film as is, and again, that film didn't even get marketed well at all. Like it wasn't like super big and loud, and like honestly, it is. It's representation in the greatest form. It's a full Asian cast that speaks in multiple languages. It kind of addresses all the issues Crazy Rich Asian did, but without all the consumerist.
Well, to be fair, they were two totally different genres as well. You know,
absolutely, they were really different genres. But also,
one is the mass marketed, and the other one was just meant for the indie circuit.
Right, but I think again, and I stand by this, it's like that is my issue with mass market cinema. Is that I don't think it can do representation until it realizes how to do that without intertwining it with sales. Because I think big cinema, especially that kind of industry, sort of attaches race to money in a really gross and lewd way.
Oh, yes.
So if it'll make you money, then you'll add this number of people of color. And if it won't, then you won't. And I think we were all just a little too comfortable buying into this big market thing because we were like, at least it'll get wide reach, which it did, which is awesome. But I'm not sure how much anybody really learned from it, except for Asians. I think Asians watched it and were like, oh, I feel represented, which is really important. But I'm not sure anyone else got anything out of it, except that was a lot of Asians on one screen. And I don't think we're in that place yet in America where we can just make representational films for fun, like without a sort of responsibility to like do something with them. Like I don't think we're there yet. I think at some point in some future we may be at that place where we can have these big representational casts and have a fun film that teaches people nothing, and it would be beautiful and great.
The Lovebirds, because I learned nothing from that film and it was superb.
Exactly, where you're like having fun, whatever. But then if you think about the ratings for that and the viewership for that movie, by the way, it's low. It's really, really low. It's really upsetting. And that's what it is. We're just not in that place in this country. And I think it's not fair to a lot of people of color to try and pretend like we are, to like kickstart it and be like, we're at the fun phase, when we're not. And unfortunately, it falls on us right now as like the representational group to make things that have a little bit more value than just fun. Especially if you have that kind of reach. Again, if it's going to make you that kind of money, at least use it for something good.
Damn.
Yeah. That's just
how that post-racial TV utopia.
Honestly, that's what I feel like we're living in a little bit. And I'm like, that's not real, though. That's just not how it functions.
I guess, I don't know, I'm still reminded of that final season of Dear White People. I guess these are spoilers. I guess stop listening if you haven't seen the third season.
Yeah.
But
you know, there's that the overall plot of the season is that regardless of who is in power, especially right with like the order of the Black society of super rich people, it's that they're still, the point of being in power is to still be in power. And so even if they have all this resource for change, they're not going to use it. Yeah. So ultimately what you're saying is we have to completely restructure the system. We can't just change the people who are in it.
Most definitely. I mean, that's the ultimate goal, right? But in order to do that, we can't just, right, we can't just make like fluff films and hope that it'll change something. You actually have to, you have to put in the work to change it first, and then you can have the fun, which is unfortunate. And I hate to say it because I want people of color to be able to not have to do that. I want them to be able to make fun films that are cute and easy. But that's just not the case yet. We're just not there where white people can watch those things.
No. And not have their preset expectations.
Exactly.
There's this play that took place in 2018 and 2019. It's called Fairview by Jackie Sibley's Drury. She's a Black playwright. And the whole her whole work, her repertoire, focuses on playing with the white gaze. All of her plays are written for it, only to fool the audience into realizing the white gaze is what is damaging their perception of the play. And I don't know how she does it. I have yet to watch her plays, but Fairview focuses on Black female characters in a middle-class setting. And in the beginning of the play, it's set up to make you think the whole thing is about the American dream, like very A Raisin in the Sun. Right. And towards the end, all the Black female characters just acknowledge to the stage, like, yeah, I'm not just a sassy Black woman, but I'm here because we got to celebrate for grandma. The plot is as basic as that. And I don't know, I feel like that's the good middle ground to have right now.
Right.
With expectation.
Yeah. I mean, again, I just think if you're making something on the auspices of representation, especially if that is your entire platform, then you have something to do. You need to have a plan about what that's going to mean. Because you can't just say, I have representation, that in and of itself means something. Because for a lot of people, it doesn't. It just doesn't mean anything to them. They're like, okay, so that's like a bunch of people of color on screen, so what? And I'm like, people of color, most people of color are not the ones who need to learn this lesson. So what are you, what is your purpose of this representation then? Just that it exists? Because that was enough in like 2005. We need to move past that a little, you know, which no. I also, ooh, actually, since I was talking about it, I do want to plug Riz Ahmed a little bit. I put it down in my notes and I feel like he's really important, especially as a sort of contrast if we're getting back to Never Have I Ever and this idea of what do you do with representation once you have it. Riz Ahmed came out with this album not long before Never Have I Ever came out.
Who is Riz Ahmed? Say it for the listeners.
He is a activist, singer, songwriter, and actor. He is a South Asian man. He's a Muslim. He is very cool. I actually don't know if he's Pakistani. He may actually be Pakistani, in which case, I don't know. I'm looking it up for all of those listening, because I can do that. Yes, he is Pakistani. Okay. So, he came out sort of with this album. It's like a spoken, it's not really even an album. It's like a spoken word slash rap slash, I don't know, album called The Long Goodbye. And it addresses, it's basically him breaking up with Britain. And he sort of explains it in a bunch of interviews and in these Zoom calls he's been doing with people during quarantine. He explains it as sort of, you know, a lot of people at this time, especially in Britain, but also in America, feel like they're breaking up with their countries. And they have this weird feeling of, you know, having to say goodbye to something that they felt like was home, but they're realizing is really messed up and they need to kind of cut those ties. And so The Long Goodbye is sort of Riz Ahmed's breakup album with Britain. And he's sort of saying, I'm kind of done with the racism and the economic issues and all this stuff that's being put on my back in this country. And I'm choosing now to be like, no, you know, we need to end. And that's where that is. And it comes at a really good time in which he's really explaining. And obviously, South Asians, you know this. You and Britain have a very, very, very different relationship than you in America. If you are a South Asian that lives in America, you are model minority status. You just need to admit that and you need to move on. If you are a South Asian in Britain, however, you are pretty much equivalent to like that of a Black person. The sort of empire and colonial past of Britain fundamentally relies on you being sort of slave status in Britain, right? So Indians were literally slaves in Britain, whereas here we weren't. We were just immigrants. We came as immigrants and that's what we were. But Indians in Britain have to deal with the sort of slave-like past. They have to deal with the whole colonial issue of just like Britain invading their home, raping their women, having this like weird, it's like more than just double consciousness. It's, you know, traumatic past, post-colonialism, all the above, which Indian Americans only really have to deal with like a fourth of, which is bad enough. And so he like addresses all these things. And in a way, he really hits home in addressing not even just Southeast Asians or colonialism, but addressing this whole idea of where are you from and what does that mean and what does home mean and what does belonging mean. And all these spoken words and these raps, he's just like, we as a people of color and as a community have given these countries everything we have, right? Even in America, for Southeast Asians, you came over here. Most of our parents came over here on work visas. You came, you had your job. They hired you and fired some white dude because they could pay you less. That's just a matter of fact. But you also probably, if you ask your parents, especially if you're from the East Coast, because I'm from the East Coast, right? Ask your parents, they probably lived in really, really horrible areas like Harlem, Queens, Jersey City. You know, from my experience, speaking to my father, if he even talks about it ever, it was, you left, if you came back from work any later than like 9 o'clock, good luck, you were getting sliced or jumped. That's just a fact of your life. Now, a lot of his friends also had the same experience. They were like, yeah, I would go. If you guys remember or don't remember, if I've ever read about it, the Dot Busters would show up and they'd slice your face. If you guys don't know what the Dot Busters are, it was a group of people in Jersey City that were against Indian people because Indian immigration was like at an all-time high in the 80s. And so this was like this group of kind of, they were sort of like the KKK, but more violent. And they basically would attack you in numerous places. Wherever they could be found, you would get jumped, sliced, whatever. And so Riz Ahmed addresses this like horrible, painful past. Even though he's addressing it in Britain, it speaks to quite a lot of the experiences here. And he does it in a way that's so poignant and hurtful and whatever, that he speaks to that whole idea of like, yeah, we exist, but it's not normal in any way. And I think especially because it precedes Never Have I Ever only by like a month or two, I'm like, that is the type of honesty that I wish Mindy Kaling had in speaking her truth. And she's on the album, by the way, guys. Mindy Kaling is on the album. She has
this little... What do you mean by on the album?
She's on the album. She is in a snippet called Mindy Take Half. And it's like a voicemail. So he splits all the songs with voicemails from people of color. And they're basically saying, hey man, I heard about the breakup, or hey Riz, like it's me, whatever. Like Mahershala Ali is on the album, Hasan Minhaj, Aziz Ansari, all these people are on the album, right? And Mindy's particular voicemail is Take Half. And she's basically like, take half of everything, like grab what you can, like that bitch, fuck her, you know, whatever. Cause it's posed as a breakup album, right? And that's what's so funny about that album, and what's so, I guess the point I'm trying to make about Never Have I Ever is that maybe Riz even wrote it, but the fact that Mindy says it, especially out of all the things, again, she could be saying, her part is always take half. And in a way, I feel like she does that in the industry a lot, is where she's willing to do whatever she can, even if it means, again, misrepresenting her people, so long as she can accumulate, I guess, power. It's not even power, it's like position, so long as she can continue to keep the position she has. And so she sort of takes what she can get and she lives with it, because she knows that like she's got strong footing as one of the very few South Asian representations. She's like, ain't nobody gonna kick me out of the industry even if I'm not the best for this community. Whereas I think personally, she again chooses to be on an album that is so dark and so deep and recognizes that whole history, and then would not do anything about it herself. So she really does, in a way, take half. She takes half of our culture and she bundles it, trundles it, puts it in a nice sparkly bag and gives it to white people.
The proximity to whiteness never fails to corrupt.
That is also true.
Is the verse you provided on this document from Mindy
Kaling? No. So that is from, I will, I guess, read it out. That is actually off the album, and it's from a song called Where Are You From? Because he's obviously making a joke for all of you people of color. You've heard it before. Where are you from? No, like, where are you really from? Right? So he says in one of the verses, he says, "And my ancestors Indian, but India was not for us. My people built the West. We even gave the skinhead swastikas. Now everybody everywhere wanting their country back. If you want me back to where I'm from, then bruv, I need a map. Or if everyone just gets their shit back, then that's blessed for us. You only built a piece of this place, bruv. The rest was us." And this is what I mean, is he speaks very deeply to, like, having to bear the burden of both violence, but also building an entire country.
Yeah.
That now that it's been built, it's built on, it's being, you know, like, these countries have been built on the top of the backs of people of color, and Riz is sort of shirking it off. He's saying, well, then I don't want it. I don't want the country, and I don't want the, you know, nonsense that comes with it. And obviously nothing is fixed by the album, but it's his way of addressing it, at least. And really, to tie this to Never Have I Ever, again, that's what she could have done. You know, she had the power to do that and yet again failed to rise to the sort of meaning. Like, what does it mean then?
So, in the case of, say, time is paused and we've only got Crazy Rich Asians and we've only got Never Have I Ever, which are heralded as, this is it.
Yes.
You want it.
Ooh.
Because what if, because this is where the crux of the issue is, right? You've only got the one form of representation, and when you get it, you're deeply unhappy with it because it's not right and it's not authentic. But it's still yours, or is it?
That's the question. I don't know if it is, right? I think, and I've linked a Wear Your Voice magazine sort of did a criticism of it, and I think they put it perfectly well when they say, and I quote, "Kaling is more interested in packaging Indian upper caste Hindu American identity for the white gaze than she is in authentic storytelling." And I think that's kind of where it lies, is that, do I want inauthentic storytelling just because I see people who look like me? Is that good enough for me? And I think for a lot of people it is. Personally, I could do without it. It doesn't do much for me except make me upset. It does not do anything for me except make me feel misrepresented, and I don't need any more of that. Because personally, what's happened with Mindy Kaling, and I don't know if this has happened to a lot of other South Asians, but I'm sure it has, but people like Mindy Kaling sort of become your end-all be-all anyways. Like, nobody goes to look for Riz Ahmed. Nobody goes to look for all the other South Asians. They're like, we have Mindy Kaling. Like, she's it. Or Aziz or Hassan. They're like, these people are it. But I'm like, oh my God, if another white person comes up to me and says, oh my God, have you ever seen the Mindy Project? Like, she talks about that. Like, oh my God, like, you're, oh my God. I'm like, no, Mindy Kaling is not, we're not the same. Whatever she is telling you on TV, it's, I'm sure it's not true. Like, you know, a lot of the things I've heard about Mindy Kaling too, especially, have come from white people. Funnily enough, guys, FYI, I've never seen The Mindy Project. I've never even seen The Office. I don't like those shows. And people have come up to me so many times repeatedly, and I'm sure this has happened to you, Ambar, where people pick the one representation you have, and they're constantly like, I get it though. Like, Mindy Kaling done taught me that, or she did this, or she said that. Like, do you also think like that? I'm like, no, I don't think like that. Like, that's one person. It's a weird thing. And, you know, that's what I was afraid was going to come out of Never Have I Ever. And it sort of is. It's like, that show is now becoming the new, you know, it's becoming the new stereotype where people are going to be like, oh, so you were like a Devi in high school? And I'm gonna be like, no, I like literally wasn't. It's not accurate. They're gonna be like, oh, your parents are gonna get you arranged married, and I'm gonna be like, what is this, 2007? No, like, personally, I could do without it, especially if it makes my life more difficult. But I think some people also need it. So I lie on a very neutral point here where I just say, I don't like it, but if it helps you, great. But if you've also not considered any of the things we've just talked about, maybe rewatch with a different lens and reconsider.
No, I think if we do that, Trisha, we're just going to get a list of white people telling us that we're being really unfair on our culture.
Yes. Ugh. They're going to accuse us of self-hatred.
Maybe we're being a little too harsh. I don't know.
Are we?
Well, I mean, that was a joke, but...
Oh.
I think, in the general scheme of when we find representation for our own cultures, I think we're allowed to be harsh, right?
Right, absolutely.
So obviously it would be a red flag if... Actually, I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't be so bad if the people who the show is written for, which is the white youth audience, for it to recognize that the show wasn't doing its job. Maybe that's not a bad thing.
Right.
But
if it exists as sort of like, if it exists in a vacuum in which people just watch it to know that it's not the best, I'm okay with that, maybe. Yeah. Like a bad example.
I wish there was someone already did it, like a reading guide, but a watch guide for Never Have I Ever, in which there's like a series of questions, like what your teacher used to do with Zoom or something, where you have a link to each article or something.
Oh, yes, with Wakelet.
Yeah.
That would be a really cool thing. See, I think that's awesome. Ava DuVernay just did something like that with When They See Us. If you've never seen that, please, please, please go watch it. But for the movie she made, or the short series she made about the Exonerated Five, she added a watch link, a sort of guide link that has, like, you know, all this information, articles, and all this stuff that you can read up on that kind of helps you process what's happening in the series, or at least give context to what's happening in the series and how the social justice system works and how it kind of works against certain people and what some of the laws are. And I think that would be a very interesting thing to do with Never Have I Ever, for sure. If Mindy Kaling could, like, make a guide, or somebody just made a guide that was linked to, like, articles about South Asians, a history of politics, South Asian immigration, things like that, that would kind of highlight the important stuff.
Yeah. I wonder what she would provide to the mom's joke about Modi in Ganesh Puja. Would she actually talk about Modi in the light that he is portrayed? Or the propaganda?
I mean, it's very quiet. Here's the thing. Mindy Kaling very much must belong to, like, an upper caste South Indian family, because that is what she, if this series is supposed to be autobiographical or semi, then that is what she's portraying. And she very minutely speaks to Modi. She, like, literally has one line about him, and it's the line where the mom's, like, outraged that he doesn't have to get Postmates. She's like, Modi would never have to get Postmates. This is why China is beating us. It's like a weirdly weird comment. But it's interesting because if she's trying to represent a certain type of Hindu and certain type of Indian, then she's doing a great job. They exist. Modi supporters who are super weird about other races and other religions are exactly like that, and they will say shit like that, you know, as freely as the day, and you'll be like, what? That's not right. That's just inappropriate. So if she was trying to sort of do a satire thing, then I get it. But I think a lot of people don't understand Indian politics at all. Like, even a lot of South Asians, I've realized in my lifetime, have no clue how Indian politics work. Like, they will just support who their parents support. They'll be like, yeah, my dad loves Modi. I don't know shit about it, though. Or, like, they'll be like, oh my God, did you hear what's happening in Kashmir? Yeah, me too. Like, I read about it. I'm like, okay, but, like, how much do you know about where that comes from? Like, how many of you know the way Indian government functions and, like, what laws are, like, yeah, you can read one or two articles, but, like, do the research, put the time in to do the research, which I think Mindy Kaling kind of fails to do here. Is, like, if she was doing a satire, then she needed to make that point much clearer, because what she, again, she lets it kind of fall flat. She's like, oh, she made this comment about Modi. South Indians feel this way about Modi, but it's not true, right? My dad hates Modi. Hates him. Right? And obviously before I went to his side, because my mom loves Modi. So before I chose a side, I did my research. I read so much about India that it actually took up all of my brain at one point in time. But now I know how everything works, right? Like, I recently just went to Calcutta and I had these conversations with like adult Indian people who are just like, okay, so at least this girl who lives in America knows something. Like, at least she's not stupid and she's not arguing some stupid point that isn't applicable to us. And I also had to listen to their point, right? If any of you know about the CAA, which is like a sort of discriminatory bill that was recently passed in India. If you go to India, quite a lot of people are not against it. I mean, there are a lot of people that are, and it's a lot of younger people, which is great. But there are a lot of people who aren't. And before I went to go attack them, or before I went to go post anything about it without understanding where that comes from, I had to first talk to all these people who were like, yeah, but you haven't lived through 1947, and you didn't live through, you know, 1971. And I'm like, okay, you make a great point that what you have seen, I could not possibly understand. This is what we all need to understand as communities, especially in South Asia. It's like, have as much empathy as you want, but do not mistake that for experience. It's not the same thing. You can empathize with someone as much as you want, but you will never understand them. You won't. You will never understand what they went through. You won't. And I try very hard to make sure South Asians especially understand that, is that before they open their mouth to you know, say something, especially about this country or India or whatever, especially if you're second generation, do your homework. Do not just rely on the immigrant experience of your parents to make a choice. You cannot say something about somebody else's country without first doing the research, because as much as you want to think India is your country, it is not. Do your research. Do not go attacking somebody's country without knowing about it.
What happened in 1971?
Bangladesh. Basically, Bangladeshi independence was achieved in 1971. It was like a huge civil war. And then Bangladesh was like, we don't want to be a part of India. We want to be Bangladesh. We don't want to be a part of Pakistan. We want to be Bangladesh. And everybody was like, no, fuck that. And then they fought furiously for quite a lot of time. And they achieved it. And Calcutta got stuck. Calcutta just stayed in India.
We should attach some links to this episode.
Yeah, no, most definitely. But so yeah, that kind of gets us to the end, is where we're getting at here, is where I'm coming from it, at least, and you can obviously follow this on bar, but I guess my definitive sort of review on Never Have I Ever is just that it does well in showing representation, not so much in actually representing people. And that's where I stand on it. But it is up to you to watch it at least and make that decision for yourself. Maybe do some research yourself.
Yes, I would say, I don't know if I'd give it maybe to every show that has representation, especially on Netflix. Always do research with it. So when you talk to your friends of color as to who their cultures represent, you don't come across as the Indian guru per se, or the Afro-Latina guru.
Exactly.
Do not claim to know someone's brownness more than they do.
Yes, that is a good point. All right, guys, see you next week. All right, guys, thanks for listening. Big shout out to Kieran Choi and his brother Connor Choi. Check them out. You can find them on YouTube. You can also find them on Facebook and Instagram. And also,
big thank you to our sound designer, Laura Feliz. She is a recent graduate of TCNJ's graphic design program. Check out her Instagram for more information.
Women of Dolor aims to alienate no one and address everyone in discussing topics of culture, society, and humanity in a way that bridges gaps of understanding and illuminates misinformation.